Okay, welcome everybody. Shavuot Tov. This tonight is February 3rd, 2024, and we had a break last week, so that was Yeshiva week. It's funny you call Yeshiva week when everybody goes away from Yeshiva. So I guess maybe that's what it means, Yeshiva coming to you. Tonight is the 11th in the series of starting with the French Revolution. And this is going to be called the Hamburg Temple. The Hamburg Temple. And really what we're doing is we're learning about the progression of the Reform Movement. How it got its jump start from the French Revolution, from the way the new French government set themselves up with consistories and took all the religions and put them under the government, and then they, you know, as they conquered Europe and they set up different kingdoms under the French government set up different kingdoms all over Europe under his brothers. So there is a consistory in another place, and we spoke about the consistory in Westphalia, and there was a person by the name of Isaac Jacobson, and who already was involved, and he really felt that he wanted to take the Jewish religion and modernize it, update it, make it fit with the times. And because he was a real radical, a real changer, and he used the consistory to use his changes and force it upon the people in Westphalia. Westphalia was really northern Germany, a certain area which originally was part of the Holy Roman Empire. The French did away with the Holy Roman Empire, and after a number of years of the Westphalia community, once Napoleon fell, so all of his kingdoms fell, and it ended up by Prussia. And everything that really was part of the French was like puzzle now. It was like, you know, ugh, we don't want to have anything to do with that. And we spoke last week about the Prussian Wilhelm, who was very conservative, and he was very, very wary of any changes. He remembered still, you know, the effect of the 30 Years' War, which was when the Protestants started a new religion or a break off religion from Christianity. And Catholicism and now Protestantism, and of course the 30 years, it wreaked havoc in Europe, and he didn't want this happening again. And but in his, we said Isaac Jacobson, when he left Sießen, which was the capital of Westphalia, and he had moved to Berlin, and in Berlin he just continued what he was doing, and he opened up in the house of a very rich person there, Mr. Beer, and they had his idea of what the synagogue, the modern day synagogue, should be, with all his changes, and that's what they continued there. He was running into issues with the Prussian government, and they weren't excited about it. They did not want it at all, and they were doing everything they could to keep that minion open and going. They were playing games. They needed to redo, at the time, the Berlin Synagogue needed to be rebuilt, and their ideas were to make two different prayer rooms, one for the traditionalists and one for them. And at the end, after about 20 years of this, finally the king of Prussia had enough, and he said, that's it, no more, and they finally closed it up. And for about 20 years in Berlin, there was no such a minion. However, I just wanted to just point out this, Isbiel Jacobson, I don't know if I focused on this before, but Israel Jacobson, during his last years, basically after two, he married twice, and among both his marriages, he had 10 children. A majority of his 10 children converted to Christianity. So he had like sort of a, it's almost similar to Moses Mendelssohn. I guess we can see from what happened to his children what his movement really was. So in other words, it was in his own mind, I'm sure he may have thought he himself was Hashem Shemayim, but you see from his, what the result even of his own family was, that it wasn't something, you know, he was going against all the rabbis and people were telling him, no, that's not the way. And it's a tragic end for him. And most of his family became not from him. One of his children became one of the most prominent priests in Germany. And he wrote, he says, my father's conscious model was Moses. You know, that was his religious leader. But his unconscious model was Yashka. This is, oh, as a priest, he's writing this, and I'm just continued what he started. I mean, that's really what Israel Jacobson felt. He understood that he wanted Judaism to be just a sister religion to Christianity. So non-Jews have Christianity, and Jews have Judaism, but it's going to be the same thing, and we're going to, the synagogue is going to look the same way, and it's going to have the same outer looks and the same type of worship, and that's what happened. But Isaac Jacobson started something, and he got the ball rolling. And this is going to be, we see what's happening today with, it's just the same. It just continued on from one person to the next. And really our story is going to continue on from after Isaac Jacobson. Okay, so we were mentioning last 2 weeks ago that in the summer of 1817, the Berlin Synagogue was closed for renovations. And the Reform prayer group in the House of Beer, they were able to continue is there a way to squeeze so we can move forward just a bit? Okay, okay. So they were able to continue after a number of years, but something happened. There were three preachers in the Berlin, in the house of in Berlin, in this minyan. One of them happened to have been a person, was Edward Clay. Israel Edward Clay was, he was one of the preachers. And in 1817, he moved from Berlin to Hamburg. And now he's going to start something in Hamburg. It's going to be the next level. Okay, so far up until now, all that the Reform Judaism was a private prayer group in a house where, you know, with their own ideas, you know, their own way of doing things, with their own preachers, but that's the extent of what it was. Now Edward Clay moves to Hamburg to become the manager, the leader of a new Jewish school in Hamburg. Okay, and that's where he goes, that's where he starts, he takes over, and he starts in the school. And part of what he does in the school is on Sunday afternoon, he gives a class on religion. And Sunday afternoon, this class on religion is open to parents. It's open to the student body, the kids and parents. And during that time, on Sunday afternoon, he runs a mini service. I don't know, maybe was it a Shabbos service? Was it a weekday service? Because the Reform at that time, they only had this minyan in Berlin. It was only for Shabbos. It wasn't during the weekday. It was only something on Shabbos. But he opened it to the public, and he would do this mini service, and part of the davening, he had German poems or hymns instead of the Hebrew, and it started to catch on, and many, many people were coming faithfully week after week. At some point, he had more than 150 people in attendance. And at that point, they decided, let's make a shul. We're not going to make a shul in somebody's house. We're going to go ahead and we're going to get a rented facility. We're going to go ahead and we're going to get a shul and, you know, we'll charge membership. Or, I don't know if we'll get a rabbi, but we're going to do this like just like a Orthodox or a traditional synagogue. We're going to do this. We're going to have our own Reform synagogue. And he got other other people, like-minded reformers, Maskelin, Frankel, and Breslau, and also Gadol Salomon, who was a speaker, and they found a lot of support among the young, the women, and these are basically people that really did not know Hebrew well. And therefore, they would come to a traditional shul that everything was in Hebrew, and they did not know how to. They didn't feel comfortable there. They didn't know what they were saying. What are they going to sit there and just not do anything? So that's who they felt they could service these people. Now, today, if these people come to shul, what we have for them is a
art school.
Art school, right? We do have an art school. We also have like a beginner's minion. Right?
Yeah.
We have, especially nowadays, it becomes very popular around High Holy Days, you know, about the Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur time, they start classes in Hebrew. That's all these outreach organizations, that's how they bring them in. Hebrew, teach Hebrew. I mean, again, we're a lot of water passed under the bridge since then. This
right.
is where things are first starting. So there, instead of raising their educational level and teaching them about Torah and the meaning of tefillah and everything, they weren't getting a education at all. And instead of, you know, having the service the way it is and teaching them what it should be, instead they'll, I guess, what you call dummy down the service and make it very, very more German and also more to the times. And that's what they did in December of 1817. 65 Jewish households they were in. And they decided that's it, and they made themselves. It was called the New Temple Association. I think its Hebrew name was Kahal Bayit Chadash, or its German name, I don't even know how to say it, Neuer Israeli Schitzer Temple. Okay. Within 3 years, they had over 100 families, which was about 10% of the Hamburg population. It had seats for 142 men and 107 women. The women would sit in the balcony without a mechitza. Okay, that's how it, at least originally it was. That's how, again, everything is going to develop. You know, it's things
right.
that they're used to. And then, you know, as the fence gets broken, people just raise more. Okay, so that's how it opened up in 1818. And what did they do in the Hamburg? They did pretty much, this is Clay, he came from Berlin. So he pretty much did everything that they did in Berlin. A lot of German hymns. Also, they changed the laning. Now, there are two popular, at least they were popular, ways of laning the Torah. Today, all over the world, we lane the Torah, we finish it once a year at Simchas Torah. We happen to know that there was a 3-year reading of the Torah, where they would finish the Torah every third year. Okay, I think the Rabbi Bar Tanura writes, he's the parish in the Mishnayos, before he was from Bar Tanura in Italy, before he moved, he became the Rav of Yerushalayim. In the late 1400s. He was like the Rav, I believe it was the late 1400s. But before that, he moved to Egypt or he was passing through Egypt, and he writes that in Egypt, there were 3 shuls in a certain city in Egypt, and one shul finished the Torah every year, one shul finished the Torah every 3 years, and a third shul finished the Torah every 3.5 years. So that's the way it was there. I guess that really made sure that nobody davened in the other shul. wait a minute. I thought we're in Bishalach, you know, we're Shalach, and you know, you're all over the place. Okay, but in any case, but we do know that there were different, different ways. As a matter of fact, I think in outside of Eretz Yisrael, Bavel or outside of Eretz Yisrael had the 1 year, and I think it was more popular in Eretz Yisrael to have the 3 year. The only time we come up with issues in Eretz Yisrael is when Yontif comes out on
Shabbos,
right? If the second day Yontif comes out on Shabbos. So then we, outside of Eretz Yisrael, are reading a Yontif, a Torah reading, right? But in Eretz Yisrael, they're reading Shabbos. So they can get a week ahead of us. And right, and then they stay ahead of us until there's a double portion, a double parsha, and then they read one and one, and we read two. So I think the reason that they are more responsible to catch up to us, I mean, I guess we can never catch up to them because it's always going to be ahead. I remember one time I went to a bar mitzvah. Yeah, could you move forward just a bit? No, I'm trying to get you across. That's all. Okay. So, I was by a bar mitzvah, a nephew's bar mitzvah in Eretz Yisrael, and like, you know, it was like at a time probably right after Shavuos when they were a week ahead. And like I'm talking to the bar mitzvah boy, and I'm asking him kashas on the parsha, and he had no idea what I was talking about, and I got nervous. I said to my wife, I said I hope he's well prepared, you know, because he had no idea what the parsha was, and boy was I surprised the next day when I'm expecting them to read, you know, whether it's Shalach and they're reading, you know, Korach or it was just like. Okay, so they catch up. But here, they decided because they wanted, the reading of the Torah, people weren't, they weren't following anyway. It was in Hebrew. It was still their reading in Hebrew. So they would shorten it. There were no hosafas. There was no extra. You couldn't have extra people laying that day. I think they actually did away with the Haftorah. They wouldn't read from the Haftorah. Do we know why we read from the Haftorah? Because it was at one point in history, the non-Jews did not let us read from the Torah. The reason why they didn't want to let us read from the Torah because they wanted us to forget the Torah. But they forgot the reason why they didn't want us to read the Torah. So we asked, could we read from the Nevi'im? It's not the Torah. And they said, yeah, why not? So they forgot. If they realized why we're not reading from the Torah is because we want to forget the Torah, they wouldn't have let us read. But they let us read from the Haftorah. So the Chachamim figured out a Haftorah that was very similar to the Torah portion. So if you ever look at the Haftorah, it's very, very, it happens to be just like very, very similar. And you can see connections. And then what happened is we were able to read the Torah again. So you know how we are. We need to remember the miracle that, you know, we survived this, so we now read both. So we keep the Haftorah with the Torah. Anyway, they kept it, they changed it to a 3 year.
I have a question about this with the changes between the Haftorah. I mean, in general, the whole second Yom Tov was because in the beginning we didn't know,
and we had to keep two inside.
We had to keep two, but now that we have
it's a good question. It's not for now. So not really connected to this. But the three word answer is minagav asinu biyadeinu. What we fathers do, we do. A lot more explanation than that. Okay, so now we have a new Hamburg temple, a real shul. They have not just a, and they have, they have their own preacher. This was the constitution. They came out with a constitution. And you get an idea of this is what our purpose is. So this is the constitution of the Hamburg Temple. Since public worship has for some time been neglected by so many because the ever-decreasing knowledge of the language, right? And not too many people knew Hebrew and they weren't learning Hebrew. I think the numbers were like, most of the Jewish children were not even going to Jewish schools. So let's say 50% for sure, probably even as high as 70, 80% of the Jewish kids weren't even going to a Jewish school. So they didn't learn Hebrew or anything, which alone has until now been conducted, and also because of many other shortcomings which have crept in at the same time. Now, again, they believed that, there were certain minhagim, certain things are not applicable today. We live in a modern era and they shouldn't be put in. And also in particular, anything against the non-Jews. Like we say Shabbos after we read the lady, Shinim. Okay, but yeah, that would be an example. But if the Yakum Parkim Avarachamim, right? There's a paragraph that was actually put in. I think that was around the Tach Patat, the Chemulneki's, what they did to us, the pogroms. So there are certain things there about destroying our enemies and taking revenge, and they felt that we shouldn't put that in anymore. Also, things that like Aleinu, we will see soon, things where it showed that the Jews are special, we're different from other nations. They also took that out as well. Okay, so that's the the undersigned, convinced of the necessity to restore public worship to its deserved dignity and importance, because they felt that's what it would be, have joined together to follow the example of several Israelite congregations, especially the one in Berlin. Okay, they plan to arrange in the city also for themselves, as well as others who think as they do, a dignified and well-ordered ritual according to which the worship service shall be conducted on Sabbath and holy days and other solemn occasions. Again, not necessarily during the week, and which shall be observed in their own temple to be erected especially for this purpose. Specifically, there shall be introduced at such service a German sermon and a choral singing accompaniment of an organ. That was like their big thing. And we're going to see what the responses of all of Europe were to this. Incidentally, the above-mentioned ritual should not be confined to services in the temple. Rather, it will apply to all those religious customs and acts of daily life which are sanctified by the church, whether it's the church or synagogue, by their own nature, probably referring to weddings. I'm not sure they really meant bris milas, because already bris mila then was on the fence. Some were for it, some were against it. Outstanding among these are the entrance of, newly born into the covenant of fathers, weddings, and the like. Okay, so they were still thinking about the bris mila. Also, a religious ceremony shall be introduced in which the children of both genders, boys and girls, after having received adequate schooling in the teachings of the faith, shall be accepted as confirmants of the Mosaic religion. This is something also which Isaac Jacobson, Israel Jacobson, he was very into, and that's a confirmation. Just the non-Jews have it, the Christians have it, and he introduced it into the Jewish religion also. That's how he started his minyan in Berlin, was his son's bar mitzvah, where he turned it as well into a confirmation for his son. That son did convert to Christianity. When that son that started this whole minyan did convert. So that was one thing, and that would have been, I guess, bad enough to have their first real shul in their own way. But what really set things going was they decided to make their own prayer book. Now already is like, they're Now, in their prayer book, this is what we believe, this is what we daven, and it's not just for their own shul now. Now this could be for other like-minded rabbis that would want to introduce their types of service. And this caused a tremendous, tremendous storm. So they decided to publish a new prayer book, Seder Avoda, they called it. And unlike its one in Berlin, this is the first Reform liturgy. You know, like up until now, they may have, you know, included a few hymns, a few, you know, German hymns, but now they're going to actually change the davening. They're going to not change it as much as leave things out or say things in Germany. There's going to be the second edition to this book. That already is going to be like the next level of changing things. So the author's methodology replaced many things in Germany, plus a lot of things that were taken out were things that have to do with karbanos. Okay, because at that point the idea was, is Germany, this is our new place to stay. We're not, you know, if Hashem would have come to them with Mashiach and said, all right guys, let's go back to Yerushalayim, they would have said, we're here, we'll stay, thank you very much, but we're here, we want to be here, we don't want to go back.
And
I pulled it in from, I don't exactly know where, but however they...
Didn't they say that Berlin was the new Jerusalem?
Yes. Yes, they did. Berlin, that was the capital, right, sure. And that's, you know, the Meshach Chachma. He writes in a Dvar Torah, in his Sefer on Chumash, he had different Dvar Torah. He says, woe is to the city, woe is to us, or woe is to that community that says that Berlin is Jerusalem. And he foreshadowed the terrible things that are going to happen. And it probably is no coincidence that out of Germany came the Holocaust.
Right.
Probably. Okay.
Didn't they say that about Vilna as well?
Didn't they what?
Didn't they say that about Vilna as well? Vilna was also supposed to be called Jerusalem.
Right, but Vilna, they did not mean it to replace.
Oh, no.
You know, at the time when they said it, all the issue, that was the center of Jewish learning.
Right.
Probably.
In a positive way.
Yeah, in a positive way. That's, you know, it's Yerushalayim, but of course, they were all waiting for Mashiach.
Right.
It's not like they.
Not like we're staying here.
Right. I'm sorry,
I should have raised my hand. I'm just wondering, the thing is that the Chachamim put, you know, return to Israel everywhere,
and
all
they're
the
going
time.
To,
that's like huge,
right,
a huge
right.
part of our.
Correct. And they're going
to
take it out.
To
again,
us.
They're going to, they don't want to. You know, it's not looking, they didn't want it to have everything that was in the Seder and add their things. They wanted to replace what the original was and have a new service that people would be inspired by. So they, you know, one of the things they could take out is, we don't believe in karbanos. We don't want to go back to the old, ancient, sacrificial, you know. So they basically took it out. If it could be read in a like a parable type of a way, like, you know, then they kept it in. But basically that's going to be the new norm. That's going to be the goal and the new what they wanted.
So
they kept that in, at least the first
that.
One, right? Because they felt that line did not have to, right? The question is on the Sefer's anyway, Nina B'Shuv Kol Tzion B'Ruach Amin, but they interpreted it in a parable type of a way, metaphorical type of a way, that not that we really want to go back, but we should see like Hashem was in with us back then, and Hashem would be with us now.
There's another thing also, disconnect, they don't believe in Chazal, right?
They're disconnecting themselves. Yeah, they believe, like, Everything in the Christian religion, everything is developing. You know, the New Testament was developed, it became, you know, the old became the new. And things are always adding, and you're adding on to what was. So here today, we also believe that we're adding. This is new times, and it calls for new type of service. So they, you know, that was then, but not for now. Still at this point, we'll see soon, but at this point, they still, if they could find a source in Chazal for what they're doing, they would look for it. They would take it. But not that they, if they didn't find the source, they would do it anyway, right? But, you know, at this point, if they found, you know, reasons of why the organ should be permitted, so then they would bring it. Ah, it should be permitted, because it says it's written here, and the Gemara there, or... okay, and they basically, their idea is they did not really want to return to back to where it was. What I did is I just took a few things of what their siddur, what they changed. So let's say if you did the Friday night service. So we first got a Lachon Aranana, right? We have a whole series of the Pitlach, and they instead had a German version of Matovu without the first sentence, right? Because Matovu Alecha Yaakov is saying how Yaakov is better. So they took that one out, and then they had a German version there. Lachadodi, again, a German version. 92, I don't remember what that was, but they actually kept that in Hebrew. 93, they took out, one is Kaddish, half Kaddish. Huh?
Mishmashiach.
Oh, that's Mishmashiach Yom HaShabbos? Okay, they took Mishmashiach.
Yeah. It's tough to
pay that. Oh, no. Is 92 Mishmashiach Yom HaShabbos? But then the next one is Hashem Melech, that they took out, that they didn't do. One is Kaddish to a half Kaddish. My river, Rabin.
Sorry, what is the German hymn?
Oh, I don't know what the German hymn was. It was a poem that they said instead of Lecha Dodi. We say Lecha Dodi, look for us. They had some German song that they would sing in German. So was it the same as Lecha Dodi? I don't know. But it could have had the same ideas.
Was it religious?
I don't know. It had to have been, you know, had to be somewhat religious because they held themselves as being religious, right? So it was like a prayer that they're trying to pray to Hashem, right? To God in their own way. So probably it had something to do with either Shabbos or maybe it was a translation of Lecha Dodi, but it was...
That's helpful.
Yeah, right. I don't know. I apologize. Ma'ariv Aravim, the first bracha of Ma'ariv, German version. Ahavas Olam, German version. So these were said, but in Germany. Shema, three paragraphs, the same. That they kept, at least at this point. Emes V'yamuna, the bracha afterwards, German version. Hashtivenu, the second bracha after Shema, again, German version. So far, you know, in Ma'ariv, they're saying most of Ma'ariv in Germany. In German, as opposed to in Hebrew. Bishamru B'nai Yisrael, German version of Bishamru, with a different introduction. Half Kaddish, they would say half Kaddish. Then they would say the Hebrew Shemona Esrei. Seven brachas, German version of the seven brachas. Right? We have Shabbos containing no other big changes. There was one change that they did instead of Goel, maybe Goel to bring a redeemer, they said maybe Geula, bring a redemption, that we should be in a better situation, but not that we want Mashiach to come. In the first Siddur that we're seeing here, that was the only major religious shift that they put in. Otherwise it was basically, seemed like it was basically either they left it out or they just said it in German. Bayechulu, they said Bayechulu in Hebrew. Okay, and in the day, I didn't go through the whole day, but we have Berchas Me'ein, still at night, Berchas Me'ein Sheva, they kept that the same. Kol Kaddish, they kept it the same. Bei mir mit Legion, they had a German hymn. Kiddush, they kept that. Aleinu took out. That was gone, because Aleinu is the, how we are, we have a special mission in this world to serve Hashem, right? After Modu, Mishamu, right? We have a different mission, and you read it, it's a beautiful paragraph on what we're here to do. But that didn't fit into their ideas of what the Jew should be, so they just took it out. Mornus Kaddish with a new introduction. Yigdal of Adon Olam, they had a German version of Adon Olam. And the morning, Adon Olam Yigdal, a German hymn, they took out morning brachas. They didn't take any of the morning brachas. The second sitter, we'll see it inside, but the second sitter had more dogmatic changes, but put brachas back in. It's going to be 20 years later, they're going to make a new sitter, which is going to upset the status quo, whatever. They agreed on, it's gonna come up again. Elokai Neshama, German version. Brachas, they took it out. Yehi Ratzon, German version. Okay, this is Yola Yehi Ribon Kol Olamim, German version of Ribon Kol Olamim. Aval Anachnu Shema and Atahu, German version of Avalanachu, probably the Shema they kept, and after the biblical, rabbinical passages dealing with sacrifice, took it all out. Kaddish Rabbanan didn't do it. This is Mizmar Sheikh Hanukkah Sabbais to David, took it out. Warner's Kaddish took it out. And then they started into Psukim and Zimra. So this is what their sitter, you know, looked like. You could already see it's a lot different, and of course it caused a storm among the area. Now, when this came out, so the Hamburg rabbinical court, Hamburg at the time did not have a rabbi. The rabbi had died. They did not appoint another rabbi. I don't know why, if they felt they didn't need it, or they were in the process, or they couldn't find somebody suitable. But there was a Beis Din that was actually running the from community. It was held in by Baruch Ben Meir Oser. And, when this came out, he put a ban on the new shul, and that's it, divided the community. Mm-hmm. Now, at the very same time, there was a person by the name of Elazar Lieberman. Now, Elazar Lieberman, he was like really off, and he came out with a book. One of them was Or Nega, or Nogat Sedek, and Or Noga. But these books were basically his distortion of Gemara and all traditional sources to support the reform changes. Now, his first book was mainly for Berlin, but whatever he said about Berlin could be applied to Hamburg. So just at the time as this sitter came out, this Sefer also came out. And it came out at a time where, wow, like the Hamburg shul said, look what we got. We now, not only did we have a sitter, but we now have some rabbi who put out an entire sefer supporting everything that we're doing. And now already, like that put the from community on the defensive. So this is Eliezer Lieberman. He had a Noga HaTzedek, followed by a Noga. Which is his own views in favor of reform. It is prefaced by two poems, one from Chorin. Chorin was the first reform rabbi in Hungary. He is going to first come out in favor of the sitter, and I guess we'll see, but whatever, he got a lot of pressure from the Chassam Sofer, who I don't know if we'll get to tonight on this, but the Chassam Sofer was like one of the leaders against reform. And Chassam Sofer did an unbelievable job keeping out reform and all this out of Hungary. So he did an unbelievable job, him and his son and his grandson, the Chassam Sofer, the Shevet Sofer, and they had very, very close relations with Franz Joseph and the Habsburgs, and they were able to keep it that the Neologs, which is what they were called, is did not make too much headway. I guess that really is for another time. But the Chassam Sofer went to Chorin and forced Chorin to make a retraction, which he did, but with an explanation of why he said what he did and what he meant. And Chassam Sofer only published his retraction. Didn't publish what his excuses and what, you know, his other narishkeit was. Chorin was not too happy about it. And eventually he's going to retract from his retraction. He's going to go back, especially when the second sitter comes back. So,
what year are we talking?
This is 1819. Okay, 1819, 1819. Okay, and then what happened is so basically they the Hamad Rabbinate now started sending this issue to the Rabbanim all over Central Europe, all through Germany, all in Germany, Hungary, all through Italy. You know, this is what's happening. Now, what had happened before this is that like. Shilas were coming from Hamburg and Berlin to the Italian rabbis. Let's say, I mean, this whole thing about an organ in the shul. This is not the first time. It's been there for over 10, 15 years in these private, you know, shuls, kind of, you know, prayer groups. And they sent it to, like, Italian rabbis. And the Italian rabbis, ooh, nice theoretical Shaila. But they didn't know who they were talking to. And they answered it, you know, yeah, it could be under the circumstance, whatever. The truth is, under the circumstances that would be necessary to play would be so, like, so many conditions, it would be only theoretical and not, you know, practical. There's really no way, you know. So Israel Jacobson had a guy playing the organ, you know, at some point they would change on that. But, you know, was it permitted? Is it like Chukos HaGoyim? Whatever issues, and I don't know if I'm going to get to there are tshuvos that came out showing why it's wrong. But they originally didn't know who was asking the questions. But now...
Why would that make a difference?
Because now when you're being asked a question from people who are not traditionalists, and they're looking to just break away. So I'm giving you a tarot, you know, you're asking like a theoretical question, you know, what could be about anything. So theoretically, well, it may not be for this or that, but there's also minhag, common practice. We don't do this. So now they when they realize what's going on and why they were asked the questions to begin with, their responses now are gonna be totally the opposite. These are from rabbis realizing, hey, wait a minute, this is not just a theoretical situation or like, you know, people that may want to, these are people outside the camp and they're not, they're straying and they're going to use us, you know, on a theoretical level to say, well, theoretically, you could just, so let's just do it. So they're going to change and they're going to give very strict, responses, and now they're sending these responses to this Beis Din of Hamburg, who sent out these letters. So they sent out these letters to everybody. What should they do? This is what's going on, and now the responses they came back. Now also, like up until now. You know, they probably looked at it, okay, there's a small rabbi here with a few people and a few people here, and maybe they figured it would all start to die out, and it would just, you know, that's it, it was nothing. But now already they're beginning to see this is a movement. It's not just something that they can just dismiss. It's beginning to form as a movement. Probably next week we're gonna see how first by the name of Avram Geiger, who is probably a name that he's going to start to organize things in Europe, and he's going to come to America, and, you know, he's really going to get the reform, like, to be, if not the major branch of Judaism, but a very, very, very big, big branch. Okay, so, okay, this is all what they did. We spoke about this. Okay, so in 1819, the Italian communities, they started, this is, they came out really, really harsh, and they started like saying really what it was. Moshe Sofer, he had Corin just recant from what he said, and later we're going to see Corin is going to just go back to what he said. Lieberman, at the same time, he wasn't just done with writing books. He wanted, you know, he was going on a tour. You know, he's like going from city to city trying to, you know, popularize his views. And he actually went to, this is where I think Corin may have gotten one of his jobs. He found himself in Vienna, and they were so impressed with what Corin, with what Lieberman had to say that they said, hey, maybe we can start a shul here also in that spirit. And I'm not sure if that's where Corin ended up. But that's, again, this is what was going on at the same time as the rabbis were now having to respond. There was also another person, Peter Beer of Prague. And he's trying to get the government that the Jews should only daven in German. He held that, his view was like deism, right? Was he the one? The approach of deism is really that Hashem created the world, and that's it. He doesn't care anymore. It's, you know, you do what you want. Hashem doesn't want a relationship with us. That's how he understood things. I don't think the Reformers even were holding where he is.
Right.
They were a lot more strong, so to speak.
Some of the American fathers.
I'm sure eventually that's where it goes, you know. And you go in that direction. Okay, so now they came out with something called Eilat Divrei Ebris. So it was these rabbis went from place to place, and they got all these different tshuvos of what they said about them, and they put it all together, and they came out with a sefer called Eilat Divrei Ebris. I just wanted the next one. The response that we received was published. They received 22 responses signed by 40 rabbanim. Some were from the Bezins of the various cities. That's why there's more than one, because instead of just the rabbi signing his name, they got the entire the Bezin of the city. And this was the response to, showing that this is wrong, and don't quote us or misquote us. We're just telling you that what they're doing is against Torah.
Didn't some of this stuff end up in the press? Various Jewish newspapers and publishing letters. A lot of this
it could be then. I mean, this has been going on always. What I'm not sure what you're referring to, but it was also when the Haskalah movement is going to move to the East, it's going to take on a different form. And there they use the power of the press more one against the other. Okay, here the press that they're reading is not the same ones that the from people are reading. I mean, just no shyness one to the other. But there, when finally this is gonna come make its way to Eastern Europe, where then already there's gonna be a lot of polemics in the newspapers and in the press. Okay, this was again about the organ, they said so many limitations, it was really theoretical. Just before we go into all the tshuvas and everything, I don't know if we're going to hit that tonight, but what happened in Hamburg? So what happened basically in Hamburg besides, okay, so you have the shul, it's gaining adherence. People feel that they don't know Hebrew. They want to go to a service that they can relate to. So there's a person by the name of Lazarus Ressa, if I'm saying his name correctly. And he was like a part of the member of the Hamburg community. And basically what he wanted to do is, he said, look, let's see if we can give these people, make them feel comfortable in a religious shul. Let's see what we can do for them.
First conservative.
Right. No, he wasn't. But we're going to get to conservative because it's going to come out now with this schism. So far, somebody's going to try to pull in something in the middle. So basically what he did is he wanted to hire somebody that would be able to relate to these modern people and also to help fix up the education system. And they got a person, his name was Rav Isaac Barnes. Rav Isaac Barnes, they brought him in. He was a Talmud of Rav Bing, who was the Rav of the previous generation. He received smicha from Rav Bing. He was appointed to his bezin. He also, Rav Bing at the time, noting that, you know, if a rabbi in those days needed to relate to people, they had to have some sort of a decree. So if I'm not mistaken, Rav Bing himself went to university and he would carefully monitor his students and say, you should go to university, and again to get the degree, whatever was necessary, either the learning that they had to learn, the secular knowledge, but probably also to get the credentials, to get the letters at the end of your name, so people would listen to you. And that's what Barnes, he had a degree from Würzburg. And what he did is, when he came in, he did a few things. The first thing is he didn't want to call him rabbi. What do you call him, right? He needed a certain respect from the community, but if he's calling rabbi, the modern people won't listen to him. Reverend, so he decided on the name for himself. He called himself Chacham. So he was called Chacham Barnes. He spoke he did speak in German, and he put on the robes of the priests of the time. And that had a tremendous effect because the Jewish community had to pay taxes for the Jewish community, plus the Hamburg Shul, you had to pay taxes for the Hamburg Shul in addition. So once Rabbi Barnes was speaking, and they felt comfortable with him speaking, so they felt he was able to draw many of these people back, and there was no need almost for the Hamburg community. Okay, he also upgraded the yeshiva, and he did wonders. In other words, he slowed down the growth of the Hamburg temple. And he brought people in, and he was giving a real Torah Dikah message. He was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, and I'm sure we're all familiar with one of his biggest Talmidim, which was Reb Shamshel Raphael Hirsch.
Oh, wow.
Shamshel Raphael Hirsch. Of course, we're going to talk about him but in the future, but Reb Shamshel Raphael Hirsch was a student of Isaac Barnes. And he learned from him. He saw how he handled the community. Next week, we're going to pick it up because after about 20 years of this, of Rabbi Barnes there, and everything, you know, the lid was on, whatever accommodations, the temple came with the shul and with all the people, it's going to be changed. A few things happened. First of all, the German attitude towards the Jews are going to change. There's going to be anti-Semitism that's going to flare up from the 1820s to the 1840s. But basically what's going to happen is the Hamburg Temple is going to come out with a new sitter. And they're going to upgrade or update their sitter that they came out with, and that's going to again spark everything and bring everything to the front. So we're going to pick this up either we'll bring some of the Jews what they asked for, what was wrong with the Hamburg Temple, and we're going to continue with the story how it's just going to start to organize and become even a stronger force. All right, any questions?
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.